Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here and to be given the opportunity to talk about this work I have been doing with Thomas Green, my supervisor, together also with Tom Pugh and Aaron Palti in these two preprints recently. So here is an outline of my talk. I will start giving you some introduction with some motivation for F-theory in general and the case of spin 7 manifolds in particular. And I will also review some material on the duality between M-theory and F-theory. And this will allow me to tell you what is the strategy we have followed to get our results. And also would like to tell you immediately what are the main features, the main insights that we were able to achieve. After this, I will describe the geometries we have been studying. In particular, these are a special class of spin 7 manifolds that are obtained starting from Calabi-Yau fourfolds by means of a suitable quotient. And I will give you some more details about how this involution, this quotient structure, and the vibration are related, and how the fixed loci of this involution look like, because this is important for understanding the F-theory setup. After this geometric part, I will move on to trying to determine the effective action of this kind of F-theory compactifications. And in order to do this, I will start on the M-theory side of the story. So I will give you a short review of M-theory and spin 7 manifolds, contrasting them to the Calabi-Yau fourfolds. And after this, I will see how, for this class of spin 7 manifolds we are interested in, the effective action can be obtained looking at the truncation of a Calabi-Yau effective action. And after this three-dimensional discussion on the M-theory side, I will address the problem of going to the F-theory side, and namely uplifting the effective action to three to four dimensions. And finally, I will like to tell you something about the weak coupling limit, because we have learned a lot from this analysis. In particular, we have seen what happens in the sense limit of the elliptic vibration, and as a result, what kind of objects we find in the weakly coupled type 2B picture. And after this, I will just come to my conclusions. Okay, well, motivation for F-theory can be found, first of all, in motivation for string theory itself. We know that it's the best candidate for unifying all known interactions. It's indeed a theory of quantum gravity, at least perturbatively, and it's able to provide a UV completion for four-dimensional effective field theories. Moreover, it implements gauge interactions in a natural way, and also elements like chiral matter and multiple families can be engineered in this framework. So it's extremely promising. And if we now look at the huge web of various superstring theories and constructions, F-theory in this web is somehow a particularly interesting corner, because it's able to unify various possible positive features. For instance, it's able to engineer exceptional gauge groups, like heterodic theory is able to do. And this is, of course, useful if one is interested in, for example, gut model building. But on the other hand, like in type 2, gauge fields and matter are localized in internal space. And this makes possible, for instance, to study them locally. On the other hand, if we now want to come back to a global picture, in F-theory, we have the hope to use some tools of modular stabilization from type 2B or M-theory that are much better understood, say, than their heterotic counterparts. So F-theory is somehow an extremely interesting setup. So what is F-theory, just in a nutshell? It can be approached from several perspectives. Probably the most conservative one is just to see it as a reformulation of some kind of type 2B vacua. In particular, those are vacua in which the axial dilaton of type 2B is allowed to vary non-trivially over the compactification manifold. And this is encoded geometrically in the complex structure parameter of an auxiliary 2 torus that varies over the base. In these ways, we are able to go beyond perturbative string, because the coupling that is the string coupling is encoded here and can, it doesn't have to be small everywhere. And also, if we look at the vibration, it will in general become singular. For example, in codimension 1 loci on the base, we will find singularities that signal the presence of space-time-filling 7 brains. And at higher codimensional loci, we have further enhancements of singularities, and those are responsible for the presence of charged matter under these gauge fields. If we're interested in determining what is the total amount of supersymmetry preserved by such a configuration, we have to look, we have to see what is the total holonomy of the vibration. In the usual case, this is supposed to be Calabi-Yau fourfold, since we want to have minimal supersymmetry in four dimensions. Okay, in this respect, it means that what I have just been talking about fits into a much broader set of four-dimensional compactification related to special holonomy manifolds. And those, so special holonomy manifolds play a preferred role because, well, precisely thanks to their special holonomy, they give us lower dimensional theory with some amount of supersymmetry. And this also means that we have more control over compactification compared, say, to the case in which we just compactify on a generic manifold. And moreover, powerful mathematical tools have been developed to study these geometries, so that we have, so those are preferred in the generic set of manifolds we could consider. And here I just put a short list of the most popular ways to get a four-dimensional theory using this kind of special holonomy manifolds. So one can use Calabi-Yau threefold, starting from any superstring theory, then depending on the amount of supersymmetry one wants, one has to consider an oriented fold in type two. But we can also consider seven-dimensional manifold of special holonomy using compactifying M-theory on them. And somehow we can think of F-theory in a Calabi-Yau fourfold, at least heuristically, as a sort of 12-dimensional theory compactifying on this kind of special holonomy manifolds in eight dimensions. But here comes the point. If we look for in the Berger's classification of all special holonomy manifolds in the eight-dimensional case, it turns out that the SU4, the Calabi-Yau case, it's not the largest possible special holonomy manifold. So between the Calabi-Yau case and the generic Riemannian manifold, we have spin 7 holonomy manifolds. So in this respect, trying to make sense of F-theory in this kind of manifolds would complete this list and would give us another construction that gives a 4D theory using special holonomy. So this sounds interesting, and indeed this framework has for sure something something special in it. Okay, let me mention that this idea of F theory in spin 7 manifolds is not new at all. Actually, it's as old as F theory itself. In his original paper, Waffa has mentioned extensively this case, and we can see why it's special if we look at the number of supercharges involved. In the familiar Calabi-Yau fourfold case, we know that we have four supercharges in the lower dimensional action, and we can make sense of them both in 3D and in 4D. It's minimal supersymmetry in four dimensions, and in the M-theory dual, we'll review in a moment, this is n equal to supersymmetry. Now, a spin 7 manifold will preserve half of the supercharges, and this is perfectly sensible in 3D, it's minimal supersymmetry in 3D, but it's not clear how to interpret it from a four-dimensional perspective, because there's nothing like a half of a minimal spinner. So this leads to the hope that maybe spin 7 holonomy manifold and F-theory are able to get a non-supersymmetric theory still using a special holonomy geometry. And this would be extremely interesting because well, okay, it's for sure interesting phenomenologically to explore non-supersymmetric setups in F-theory. But on the other hand, the fact that there is some special holonomy involved, or if you prefer, the fact that there is some amount of supersymmetry in three dimensions, could probably improve the control that we can have over this setup compared to a random compactification that just breaks supersymmetry at a very high scale. Okay, so this is so the motivation for this kind of constructions. But on the other hand, we immediately find some serious puzzles. for instance, we would like to, it's extremely useful to have control over the duality between F-theory and M-theory. And usually this is performed using a circle. But here we have a problem, because this kind of minimally supersymmetric theories in 3D can never come from circle reduction of any four-dimensional theory. So this, we have to figure out how to understand this. And also, even though the mathematical notion of an elliptically fibrous seven manifold is not completely clear, there are hints that in these geometries, the base manifold has to be non-orientable. This was pointed out by Witten in a note added to original Buffer's paper. And in this case, it's hard to make sense of a type 2B interpretation, because we would like to have, of course, an orientable space for type 2B compactifications.
But it's known that you can put F-theory on these spaces? I mean, does it?
No, that's the problem. It's it was not known. I mean, what we have is a special spin 7, and in this special case, we can make sense of it. And somehow, I would say that both these issues are related to our heuristic picture of a 12-dimensional theory compactified in something that looks like Minkowski times this spin 7 Holonomy manifold. So maybe this is not the right way of thinking about this problem. So what we did is was just to start with M theory and trying to make sense of F theory as somehow emerging in a specific limit. And what happens in this case, or at least in the cases we are able to control, is that this hidden assumption that Minkowski is the non-compact part has to be released, and we will see that something else appears.
I guess in addition to the second point you raise, I guess you have in mind also that my normal notion of how to think of 2D in terms of the M to F limit is just dead in the water, because there's no second circle to perform the T-duality on. So I don't really think of taking the one circle small to take the 2A limit, and then I think of getting decompactified type 2B by doing a T-duality on the other circle. And, is that tied in with point 2 here?
No, I would say that the torus fiber is still there. The problem is that it has to, it's the structure of the fibration that it's a bit strange compared to the Calabi-Yau case. But we will see, I mean, we still have both cycles and they both play a role in the what follows. Okay, so this is our approach. We approach F theory starting from M theory, and I mean, this can be a very general approach indeed. So suppose that one has a suitable eight-dimensional manifold that has some vibration structure, and the generic fiber looks like a T2. Then what one could do is to consider M theory in these kind of geometries, and then perform a special limit in the modular space where the fiber of this T2 goes to zero. And then by the chain of dualities I will review for you in a moment, one finds that a new direction becomes large in the dual picture, and then we are effectively left with a four-dimensional theory. Now, in general, I would say we don't know, or it's extremely hard problem to find what is the most general structure that allows this construction, this program to be carried out. So we didn't consider the most general case, but we rather focused on a special class of spin 7 manifolds that are obtained using Calabi-Yau fourfolds. We were inspired by the work of Joyce, who used these techniques to provide the first compact examples of manifolds of spin 7 holonomy. And in some of his constructions, he precisely starts with a fourfold with an anti-holomorphic quotient. So what we did is we started with an elliptically fibered fourfold, so that here we have control over the vibration, take this quotient in such a way that somehow the spin 7 inherits the suitable vibration structure to make sense of F theory. I would like to mention that this is by no means the only way to get spin 7 manifolds in general. There are other possibilities, especially for non-compact manifolds, explicit metrics are known. It would be extremely interesting to find a non-compact metric that looks like a torus vibration. To my knowledge, this is not available in the literature, so we haven't considered non-compact situations. But this could be another possible direction in the in considering F theory and spin 7 manifolds.
Do you know if there are compact cases other than the ones considered by Joyce?
I mean, George also has some torus quotients, not only radial quotients. But I'm not sure if there are other.
So the original value has to have a Z2 symmetry, an interval of Z symmetry, in order to make this quotient.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't. But it's still its holonomy is still can still be general. It can still be SU8 whatever. SU4, SU4, and SU4.
But you spin one of the quotient
more like that. You will break it. Are you spin 7 containing SU4?
No, it's the other way
around. The way around. Okay, so the holonomy becomes more, the quotient in the holonomy more special.
Holonomy is less special than special.
It's closer to the generic case.
Okay, so.
Okay. Okay, as promised, I would now like to review some facts about how this general story to get F theory out of M theory works. So the geometry involved is a fourfold. Well, I would consider the fourfold case because it's best understood. Then it's an elliptic vibration over some Kähler threefold. And now if we look at the generic point on the base, we will find a fiber that has the topology of a torus. And so in particular, we will find two one cycles, let's say A and B. And here is the route to F theory. We take the limit in which this torus shrinks to zero size. It means that both cycles shrink. So one of them, say the A cycle, is interpreted as the one that gives type 2A out of M theory. So we get type 2A on a very small cycle B, but then it's convenient to move to a T-dual frame. And then we get type 2B on a large, so on a circle that is growing large.
In the end,
then type 2B will live on the base manifold, this large circle and three-dimensional Minkowski space. Now, this argument is a bit heuristic. I mean, it has to be extended fiber-wise, and there are some subtleties. For instance, the fact that we start with something that it's not a trivial vibration becomes a non-trivial profile of the axial dilaton in type 2B, and that's precisely what makes F-theory interesting, one might say. And also, I would like to stress that this process cannot be understood in supergravity alone, because it always involves non-perturbative states. In particular, since this torus will eventually shrink, it will become at some point much smaller than the Planck scale in 11 dimensions, so that M2-brain states wrapping this cycle will become light. And actually, if one follows this duality, they are mapped to the KK modes of the fields that live in this circle that it's decompactifying. So one might say that it's precisely thanks to M2 brain states that local Lorentz symmetry is restored on the other side of the duality. And a very similar story holds for the gauge group that one can have. So we can have non-abelian gauge groups if the torus pinch is in an appropriate wave on codimension one loci on the base. But in order to study M theory on these kind of spaces, it's convenient to resolve them. In such a way, from the gauge point of view, we break the gauge group to its Coulomb branch. But if at the end of the day we want to recover the full non-abelian group in the effective action, once again we have to rely on M2 brain states wrapping these exceptional devices. So M2 brain states are also responsible for restoration of gauge symmetry. Okay, so this gives us also a recipe for the effective action of F theory. So we have to start with M theory, and we can use the supergravity approximation because we are working on a space that is resolved and in which the torus fiber has a finite size. And therefore, we get a three-dimensional effective action with abelian gauge group. On the other hand, what we are really looking for is the F-theory effective action, that it's, we know it's a non-abelian four-dimensional action. So what we can do is to parametrize in a suitable way this action we are looking for, put it on a circle, and the circle is related to this circle that decompactifies, break the gauge group in three dimension, giving birth to the scalars in the vector multiplets, or going to the Coulomb branch, so that we also have a 3D effective action with abelian gauge group. And then we can start comparing the two sides, the M theory and the F theory side. And this can be done in particular has to be done in the F theory limit. So it's a special limit on this side where some scalars that are related to the volume of the fiber and of the resolution cycles are going to zero in a controlled way. Then if we single out what are the dominant terms in this limit on this side, we can match them with the data coming from this side, and at the end of the day, reconstruct the data of the four-dimensional action we were looking for. And this has been done in four dimensions, also in six dimensions. It's basically the same mechanism. So what we try to do is to repeat the same story basically with this kind of spin 7 manifolds. So this is the strategy, therefore. So first of all, build the appropriate geometries using Calabi-Yau quotient. First, consider the M-theory side, and then uplift to four dimensions. And as an aside, also maybe consider the weak coupling limit, because this is interesting to get some complementary information, so to say. So what is the outcome of what we have found out? Well, in the cases we have considered, it turns out that what used to be a circle that decompactifies in the type 2B limit now becomes an interval, because there is some Z2 quotient acting on it. And as a result, this point here, the uplift of the effective action, is no longer performed using a circle, but rather an interval. And also, this interval picture is confirmed by the weak coupling analysis, because what we find is actually a four-dimensional theory that nonetheless has boundaries. So we find quite, we were a bit surprised at first. We find indeed a supersymmetric bulk coupled to localized objects at the end of the interval that only preserve n equal 1 in three dimensions. So this is quite different maybe from what, I mean, this is not a non-supersymmetric theory in the bulk, but this is how we, somehow this n equal 2 1 half, roughly speaking, is realized in for the spin 7 manifolds we have considered. Okay, so having said that, I would like to move on and say something about the geometries involved. So first, I would like to give you some remind some facts about spin 7 manifolds. Those are eight-dimensional Riemannian manifolds and have this restricted holonomy group. One can show that this is equivalent to the existence of a so-called Cayley form. This is a globally defined, now we're banishing harmonic self-dual form. It's actually responsible for the reduction of the structure group from the generic spin 8 to the spin 7, and also can be used to define calibrated four-dimensional submanifolds. And as far as spinors are concerned, one can show that the two spinorial representation of spin 8, distinguished by chirality, behave differently under this reduction of the structure group. And in particular, only for one of the two chiralities, which one is more like a matter of convention, we find a singlet. So it means that we just have one Majorana-Weyl parallel spinner compared to the Calabi-Yau case in which we would have two of them, or if you like, just a complex Weyl spinner. And also we can construct bilinears of these spinners, as it's usually done. And it turns out that thanks to the reality and chirality properties of ether, only one bilinear is non-trivial, and this is precisely the one that corresponds to the Cayley form. Moreover, just like in the Calabi-Yau case, it turns out that the spin 7 condition is enough to ensure Ricci flatness. But let me stress that spin 7 manifolds in general don't have any complex structure. So how can we get a spin 7 manifold if we are given a Calabi-Yau fourfold? Well, the extra ingredient we need is an anti-holomorphic isometric involution. So a map that squares to the identity, preserves the metric, but flips the sign of the complex structure. We can also rephrase these conditions in terms of the Cayley form and the harmonic four forms. If we have this pair, so the fourfold and the sigma, we can consider the quotient space. Now, if we forget for a moment about fixed points of this sigma, one can show that the quotient space indeed has spin 7 holonomy. And we can also give an expression for this Cayley form on the spin 7 side in terms of the Calabi-Yau data, the J and the omega. The problem is that generically, if sigma has fixed points, there the quotient will develop orbifold singularities. So actually, this is the hardest part mathematically of the construction of the spin 7 manifolds. Joyce has proven the existence of a spin 7 resolution in a special case, namely the one in which this map sigma has just isolated fixed points that also have to sit on top of pre-existing orbital singularities of Y4. So unfortunately, this case seems to be in tension with the case of an elliptically fibered fourfold. So maybe it's not the best for F-theory. So what we decided to do is to make, basically to close our eyes a little bit and just move on with the discussion and allow for more general kind of singularities than those described by Joyce. Basically because it's, I mean, there is nothing like a good no-go theorem that says that these more general singularities cannot be resolved. Now, we haven't attacked the mathematical problem of the resolution, but in the weak coupling limit of some, in the type 2B recoupling limit of some configurations, we know which kind of stringy objects live on top of these fixed spaces. And those are, okay, they can be described in perturbative string theory, and they're mutually supersymmetric. So this is can be seen as an indirect hint to the fact that it's indeed possible to find spin 7 resolutions of a more general class of singularities than those described by Joyce. And also, okay, let me stress that the problem here is about the singularities associated to this anti-holomorphic quotient. The other kind of singularities that are ubiquitous in F theory, the ones that are responsible for non-abelian gauge groups, are not so much a concern for us, because we can always imagine to first resolve them in a Calabi-Yau way and then apply this additional quotient. Okay, well, the first requirement, if we want to make sense of F theory, we have to have an elliptic, some kind of vibration, of torus vibration. So we demand that the fourfold we begin with is an elliptically fibered fourfold. And then we have to demand the compatibility between this vibration structure and the anti-holomorphic involution. So it means that we that this sigma somehow descends consistently on the base to an anti-holomorphic involution. This map on the base will flip the sign of the Kähler form, being anti-holomorphic, but will also flip the sign of the volume form, which is a bit weird from a type 2B perspective. So if we were just to consider type 2B modded out by this, we would have a problem, because this is not a symmetry of type 2B, because it's not preserving the orientation of the base. So this is already a hint that something a little bit more exotic has to happen. And indeed, we will find that to resolve this problem, we will have to have to combine this action on the base with an action on external spacetime. Also, okay, in the simplest case, this map has a real three-dimensional fixed locus. And this is the case I will talk about in what follows. But I would just like to mention that it's also possible to have, for instance, lower dimensional fixed loci. The price to pay is some kind of orbifold singularities on the base, which nonetheless are quite under control, so it's not such a big deal. Okay, so far was a discussion about this involution that descends to the base. But now let's see how the involution works on the total space, on the vibration. Well, the first case is the one in which we look at a point that is just mapped somewhere else by the involution. So this means that the whole fiber on top of this P is just swapped with another fiber by this Z2 action. But note that the orientations of these two, heuristically speaking, are reversed because of the anti-holomorphic nature of the map. So it means that if we look at the quotient space in a neighborhood of P, on top of it, we still find the torus topologically. But its complex structure somehow cannot be defined globally anymore, because eventually we will hit this point where it should be the opposite of itself. But this is consistent with the fact that spin 7 manifolds shouldn't have complex structure. Okay, more interesting things happen if we look at a point on the base that it's actually a fixed point of the involution on the base, because this implies that the fiber on top of it is actually mapped to itself by the original anti-holomorphic involution. So we are acting on the torus with this quotient. And there are various possibilities. So let me first consider the case of a smooth torus. So here is what somehow it's probably more natural to expect. If we have an anti-holomorphic involution on a torus, one possibility is to have one-dimensional fixed lines. So one can think of this case, roughly speaking, like a complex conjugation that will single out the real part of the coordinate on the torus. In this case, the quotient looks like a cylinder with the boundary provided by these one-dimensional fixed lines. But I would like to mention that there is another possibility, namely if one has a smooth torus and an anti-holomorphic involution, it could also be that this involution acts freely on the torus. And in this case, it turns out that the quotient is a Klein bottle. The non-orientability is somehow related to this flip of orientation of the torus induced by the anti-holomorphic nature. And actually, even more exotic things can happen if one allows more special things to happen at the same time. Indeed, we can consider a point that on the base that it's fixed point and the involution, and also lies on top of some seven brain in such a way that the fiber on top of it is not a smooth torus, but rather a pinched torus. And in this case, it's possible to engineer things in such a way that there is an isolated fixed point of the involution that consists of this pinching point. Now, we haven't really fleshed out all the physics related to this case, but I would say that it's probably an interesting problem to to study further, because it hints to a strong connection between the possible gauge groups we can have related to the way this torus can pinch and the spin 7 action and resolution. And even though this might seem a bit like a baroque example, if one wants to reproduce Joy's construction, it's basically the way to go, because this is the way to get isolated fixed points in a torus vibration. But I have to say that the case we understand the best is the first one, the cylinder fiber. And for this case, we can be explicit and give a description of this using a virus test model, because in this case, we can use this equation in this weighted projected space with coefficients depending on the base. Now, the dependence on the base cannot be really arbitrary now, because we have to have a compatibility between this this vibration and the involution. But it turns out that in many examples, one can do what is probably the natural thing to do, namely to have these F and G behave in such a way that, so to say, the pullback of sigma B amounts to complex conjugation. In this case, with this simple action on the coordinates of the weighted projected space, we see that this equation is mapped to itself, and so we have compatibility, well, to its complex conjugate, and then we have compatibility. And if we look what this means for the tau of the vibration, we find this equation. So tau is still allowed to vary non-trivially over the base, but something happens at the fixed points on the base of the involution, because there we find the same point on both sides, and tau has to be purely imaginary. And this is interesting to know, because it will help us to understand what is going on in the weak coupling limit. Okay, so this was something about the geometries involved, and now let's talk about the effective action. So according to this general program of M2F theory, we have to start with M theory. So let's first consider M theory on a generic spin 7 manifold. This is a well-studied subject. I don't really have time to give you many details, unfortunately. I would just like to flash a comparison with the spin 7, with the Calabi-Yau case, which is probably more familiar. Well, as far as the amount of supersymmetry, as we have seen, we have minimal supersymmetry in the spin 7 case and n equal 2 in the fourfold case. Moreover, while on the fourfold, all the scalars that come from the metric and the freeform in M theory arrange themselves naturally as complex scalars, on the spin 7 manifolds, we rather have real scalars coming from the metric deformations and the M-theory 3-form. And this is related to the fact that this amount of supersymmetry in 3-dimension ensures that the moduli space looks like a Kähler manifold. And in this case, it splits into the familiar complex structure and Kähler moduli. But on the other hand, this amount of supersymmetry is basically so weak that we could have a general Riemannian manifold. And also, I would like to give you a couple of equations that tell us how the G4 flux of M theory translates into a scalar potential for these fields. So on the four-fold sides, we have two objects that govern the scalar potential, the holomorphic superpotential and this function T. On the spin 7 side, we have just one real function F. And you see that somehow it has a, we call that for our phi, the Kayleigh calibration, roughly speaking, is the sum of omega and J squared. So you see that there is a strong connection between these two. Okay. So one could say more about M theory on generic spin 7 manifolds, but since our spin 7 manifold is not a general one, it's rather a quotient of the fourfold, let's specialize to this case. We can then look at the effective action as a truncation of the Calabi-Yau action. If one is honest, of course, one also should include resolution modes. And this is a bit, I mean, this is harder because we don't have control over the resolution except in a very few special cases. So strictly speaking, the effective actions I will about to talk are only complete in the special case in which this involution is free of fixed points. But we believe that the main conclusions about how the F-theory setup looks like should hold even if these resolution modes are included properly into the discussion. So here I would just like to give you some details, well, the spirit of this truncation, even if it's maybe it's familiar from the orientifold truncation of type 2. It's somehow the same spirit. The idea is that since we have an action, we can split cohomologies into eigenspaces according to this, and therefore we would have positive and negative, for example, two forms. And since we know, for instance, that the Kayleigh form is negative, we are only allowed to expand it onto the negative ones, while on the other hand, the M-theory 3 form will be expanded onto the positive ones. So it means that on the fourfold, we would have anything. I mean, the VI minus and the VI plus. But now, after the truncation, the VI plus are lost, and the AI minus are lost. And this pattern can be checked for all other scalars in the game. It also works in the complex structure sector. And at the end of the day, we might say that the spin 7 moduli space looks like a real slice of the Calabi-Yau moduli space. And this discussion can be made more precise. The truncated action can be cast into a more traditional, standard spin 7 form. I won't give you details, but I would just like to flash this relation because I just showed you these quantities before. So you see we are able to map the function that governs the scalar potential in the spin 7 case and to express it in terms of the Calabi-Yau objects that we find. So exactly. So the Calabi-Yau quantities govern the spin 7 function F. Okay, and this was true for a generic truncation. Now we can see what happens in an elliptic vibration case. Now at the level of the effective action, the elliptic vibration manifests itself like an additional structure. For example, an additional structure in the H11. In particular, a special role is played by some two forms. One of them, which is called omega naught, is the Poincaré dual to the base. And the others, there's omega I, are Poincaré dual to the exceptional divisors of the resolution. I here labels the Cartan of the gauge group. Now, for simplicity, I'm considering the case of a simple monadic gauge group, but this can be generalized easily. Now, it turns out that consistency of the vibration with the involution demands that both of them are negative under this action. And so this means that if we go just one back, since they are negative, the V part will survive, so to say. But this is good news because these two real scalars, well, these real scalars, the V0 and the VIs, the first one is actually the one that governs the volume of the torus fiber, and the others govern the volume of this, roughly speaking, of these exceptional divisors. So it's good news that they are preserved because we know that the F theory limit precisely consists of the limit in which these two are sent to zero in a controlled way. And now, if this were Calabi-Yau, we would know what to do. I mean, we have these scalars, we assign them suitable scalings. they go to zero in a controlled way. We look at the dominant part of the action and match it with a circle reduction of something that we want to compare. But now we see that a circle reduction cannot work, and this can be seen in various ways. But probably the most transparent way to see it is to look at spinners, because if we take a minimal spinner in 4D, for example, realized as a Majorana spinner, it will always yield two Majorana spinners if we reduce them on circle. So this means that if we use a circle, we will never be able to get just n equal 1, just n equal 0 or n equal 2 in 3D. So we have to modify this prescription, and our proposal is to use this interval instead. Some evidence for it. Well, a heuristic argument to make this Z2 quotient plausible is to remember how this involution acting on the torus. Remember that it flips the orientation of the torus. So it means that one of the two cycles, roughly speaking, is reflected. And also remember what we have seen in the Weierstrass form. This it's not the M-theory cycle that is reflected. So we are not going to have heterotic M-theory. We rather reflect the other circle, the one that becomes large, and that's why we believe in this quotient here. More pragmatically, this space does the job, so it's able to get 3D n equal 1 for four dimensions. And further evidence for it will come out of the weak coupling limit.
So your heuristic picture works well if you've got cylinders as the quotients for the fixed locus. What happens if you have a Klein model case?
We would like to understand it better. It's not really clear here. It seems that M theory on a Klein bottle gives a type 2B set, a type 2 setup, type 2A setup, that it's actually mapped to another type 2A setup by T duality. So we would like to study this case more easily, because it's not even clear that one can get type 2B out of this. You're right, we don't know what happens in this case. Okay, so why the interval works? Well, basically because it has boundaries, and then we have to specify boundary conditions during the reduction. And as usual, we can have Neumann on Dirichlet conditions. And let's look, for example, what happens to a scalar. So suppose we're given a massless scalar in 4D, and we put them on this circle with this Z2 action. Now, if we demand Neumann conditions, we can still have a constant profile over the circle, over the interval, and so we still have zero modes, and then we still have a scalar in the massless three-dimensional spectrum. But if we decide instead to impose the Dirichlet boundary conditions, the zero mode is killed because it's frozen to be zero everywhere. And so we actually find nothing in the massless three-dimensional spectrum. And something similar happens here. I mean, usually a vector on a circle will give rise to both a vector and a scalar, but here we can only get the vector or the scalar. And the same for the spinners. As I said before, usually one would find two of them, but since we are forced by consistency to impose one of these two boundary conditions, one of them is always projected out. Okay, so this part of the story is good news, because this makes it possible to have the right amount of supersymmetry. But the fact that there is this sort of ambiguity related to boundary condition makes the uplift of the effective action a little bit trickier than the circle case. In particular, it turns out that if we look at the spinners and the vectors, so the Cartan vectors that we have in the 3D action, combining some F-theory argument with Lorentz symmetry and gauge symmetry, we are able to reconstruct all the four-dimensional couplings. But this is not true for the scalars. Namely, we can add as many Dirichlet scalars to the four-dimensional action as we like, and those are just invisible in the three-dimensional action if the interval is really small. So one might define something like a minimal uplift. So let's forget for a moment about these scalars. Suppose they're just not there. And just look for a Lorentz invariant action that gives minimal action that gives what we want to have in 3D. And if we apply this program to our n equal 1 action in 3D, the one related to n theory in spin 7, Well, it turns out that S4 is actually non-supersymmetric. And this is related to the fact that we are missing some scalars. Basically, it looks like a supersymmetric theory, but once again, we cut out a real slice of the moduli space of the theory. Okay, so it might seem at first sight that it's indeed possible to have a non-supersymmetric F-theory compactification using spin 7 manifolds. But there is a subtle issue to consider.
Yeah. Another source, specifically when if you add mysterious scalars,
Excuse me, can
you say? On a proof slide, you said you have, in addition, also have this mysterious scalars, but you cannot store the four-dimensional effective action in this method by adding those.
Yeah, exactly, precisely. The problem is that from a purely supergravity perspective, we don't know if they should be added or not. Or if you like, as an oxidation problem, so to say, in supergravity, those are just like integration constants, so to say. So we have to find some other argument to fix them. And in particular, this is related to the problem that we don't really know if this minimal uplift that we have defined is a good effective action, in the sense, does it describe all the light degrees of freedom? And I mean, we should expect it to be somehow tricky, because we know that M2 brain state play a crucial role in the whole M2F theory discussion. So we have seen that they restore local Lorentz symmetry, they restore non-abelian gauge symmetry. So are they actually able to restore supersymmetry as well? Well, to answer this question, we have to rely on some other kind of argument. What we did is we studied the weak coupling limit, and indeed, they restore supersymmetry. So it means that okay, if we forget for a moment about what happens at the boundaries of the interval, so we just look at the bulk of a very large interval, indeed we find a supersymmetric theory. And exactly this means that we do have to add some of those Dirichlet scalars, precisely one of them for each of the fields that were odd under this truncation and were truncated away in 3D. So somehow they disappear from the 3D spectrum, but they reappear in 4D to restore supersymmetry. So even if it might be maybe a bit strange at first sight, the spin 7 quotient in the bulk is just, it has no effect. I mean, the effective action in the bulk is precisely the Calabi-Yau effective action. And in particular, it has minimal supersymmetry in four dimensions. Okay, so since the weak coupling limit is really important to argue that this is really what is going on, I would like now to say more about it in a simple case in which we can use a variousness form. Here is, again, for your convenience. And in particular, we can now use sense parametrization, in which these f and g are parametrized in terms of three functions on the base plus a constant. And this is engineered in such a way that when this constant goes to zero, the axiodilaton, the string coupling is can be made arbitrarily small almost everywhere on the base, so that we can make sense of the resulting picture in the language of perturbative type 2B. And indeed, it turns out that what we find is an oriented fold of type 2B on a Calabi-Yau threefold. So this is somehow a new manifold that emerges in the recoupling limit. And this is a double cover of the base of the elliptic vibration. And one convenient way to describe it is to introduce an additional coordinate. And since it's a double cover, an equation like this tells us precisely that we have two sheets and they branch over the locus where this h goes to zero. So we see now we have this Calabi-Yau threefold. And now we have two involutions acting on it at the same time. So we have the holomorphic one, that is precisely the orientifold involution. And this can be seen as the one that flips the sign of psi. So to say, it flips also the two sheets of this cover. And we know what to expect at the fixed loci of this involution. They are 0,7 planes, because this is what is the weak coupling analysis right here. But on the other hand, the whole story started with an anti-holomorphic involution on the fourfold. We have seen that it has to descend on the base, this sigma b, and now we can extend it from the base to its double cover y3. And what we get is therefore an anti-holomorphic involution on the threefold. That roughly speaking acts like this. So it acts like the base and complex conjugate for this additional coordinate. So now we have all the ingredients. We have threefold and two involutions. And I can state what is the claim for the recoupling picture of this kind of F-theory setups. So one has to take type 2B, consider a three-dimensional Minkowski space, a circle, and this threefold, and consider the quotient by the symmetry group generated by these two transformations. Now you see that sigma H and sigma AH are the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic involutions I have just discussed. Then we have the worksheet parity operator, and also the sum factors minus 1 to the F left, that is space, the left moving space time Fermion number. But there is also a new ingredient, this R3, that denotes a reflection of this circle S1. So it acts only on the coordinate X3 of this circle. Okay. Well, one might ask why the circle here to begin with. Well, this is justified by this picture that any time that we go from M theory to F theory, there is a circle that it's decompactifying before we start taking quotients. But and also note that this anti-holomorphic involution, for example, if we look at spinors, will induce a pin-all transformation. It will flip the chiralities. So it's not a symmetry of type 2B. This is a problem that we have already encountered before in a slightly different context. But if we combine it with the reflection on the circle, we do have a geometric symmetry of type 2B. So one might think of it as a three-dimensional compactification, but the point is that the size of this circle doesn't have to be small. So we can also think in four-dimensional terms. And a few more comments. Well, what I mean, the geometric part of the story now, it's relatively clear. One might still argue, what is the origin of these string effectors, so to say? Well, okay, in the case of the O7 action, we know that it has to be like this to get an O7 plane. But we can also, but what about this factor, for example? In any case, we can. This is a type 2B setup. To check that this is the right thing to do, we can go to the type 2A, dualizing along this S1, and then uplift to M theory. And what turns out is that all these stringy operations boil down to reflections of the A and B cycle of the torus. And furthermore, those reflections are compatible with the action of the original sigma on the fourfold. So what is a geometric action in M theory becomes this kind of operations in type 2B. Okay, so this is a proposal. So we have type 2B and we have to take the quotient. But usually any quotient gives rise to some kind of localized object at the fixed points. So let's see what we find in this case. Now, the specific details depend on how the fixed loci look like on the base and on the fiber. And I would stick to the case in which we have three-dimensional fixed on the base and one-dimensional fixed on the fiber, so the cylinder fiber, if you like. Okay, now the first line is not such a big surprise. This is the familiar O7 action. It will wrap the interval just because it wraps all four external four directions. And inside the threefold, it wraps a holomorphic submanifold. More interesting is what happens to with this action. You see, this is a geometric action dressed with this stringy factor of minus 1 to the F left. The resulting objects we call X5, and I will give you in a moment more details about it. And because of the R3 factor, this is stuck at the endpoints of the interval, while inside the Y3, it wraps the fixed locus of this anti-holomorphic map, then it's a special Lagrangian submanifold. And finally, for completeness, I would like to give you the combined action of the two. And quite interestingly, even if this looks like a bit of an exotic object, the combined action is a completely standard O5 action. Once again, the R3 factor signals that those are localized at the endpoints. And inside, they will map another Lagrangian submanifold that is the fixed point of this new
composite action.
And I have to mention that the presence of O7 and O5, it means that we also have to have some D7 and D5 to cancel tadpoles. And the problem now comes is this setup supersymmetric? Now, we don't have a rigorous proof in the Calabi-Yau case, but we can argue for it because all these special submanifolds taken singularly are calibrated, roughly speaking, in the right way, and they're compatible because they say, basically because this is a special Lagrangian submanifold obtained by something that is anti-holomorphic with respect to the same structure that makes this holomorphic. But we also have performed the check in a toroidal example in which we replace the Calabi-Yau by torus. And in this case, one can show that these three objects don't break supersymmetry completely. Okay, so as promised, I would like now to give you some more information about these X5 planes. So basically, there is an orbifold action, but it's dressed with this factor. This has been studied quite extensively. And one way to see what is going on is to recall that in type 2b, S2-ality flips this factor with the more familiar omega parity transformation. And indeed, it turns out that one X5 plane is S-dual to a system consisting of an O5 plane with a D5 and its image on top of it to cancel the tadpole, because this object turns out to have no net tadpole. And furthermore, if one studies the twisted sector of this kind of special orbifolds, it turns out that it has a massless U1 vector, and this is mapped by S2-ality to the vector that lives on top of this D5. But we also find more exotic things, actually some stable but non-BPX excitations. And they are stable, roughly speaking, because of this charge. I mean, there is a charge conservation related to this U1. And in the S2-al picture with the O5 and the D5, there are strings that go from one D5 to its image through the O5. And then somehow it's the O5 projection that gets rid of the lighter states to which they could possibly decay. Okay, now that we have the weak coupling picture, we can argue more specifically for supersymmetry restoration. Actually, it's relatively clear because now we have a theory on a large interval. If the interval becomes really large, all the KK modes, the even ones and the odd ones, so to say, become light. So if we just look at the bulk, all excitations become accessible at low energies. And also, whatever lives on the boundary eventually will decouple. So that's why we find n equal 1 supersymmetry in the bulk. And now we also have an intuition about what are the states responsible for this supersymmetry restoration. Those are KK modes in type 2b. So we can map them to winding strings in type 2a and eventually to wrapped membranes in M theory. But this means that if we look at this process from the M theory perspective, this is some kind of very non-trivial enhancement in the quantum moduli space of the theory. So the conclusion is that if we look at the moduli space of a spin set of this kind, of spin 7 manifolds, in the limit of vanishing fiber, M-theoretical quantum effects, or non-perturbative states, are able to enhance it to the full Calabi-Yau moduli space that we used to have before. So it could be maybe nice to try to see this problem directly from an M-theory perspective. I'm not sure how feasible this is. But,
So the large interval limit, so the anti-holomorphic involution is now R3 times the anti-holomorphic involution in terms of its 2B picture. So it's relating fields here to fields somewhere very far away on the circle. So the local physics seems like it would be just like the original Calabi-Yau before the anti-holomorphic rotation.
Yeah, this is. Basically, all the, roughly speaking, I would say on the M theory side, all the spin 7-ness is concentrated at the fixed loci. And after this duality, it gets concentrated at the boundaries of the interval. Okay, so I can conclude. So the general recipe, so to say, if one is interested in M theory on some kind of geometry, say spin 7, probably the most but the safest way to describe it is to start with M theory on the same kind of geometries and then perform this limit. Unfortunately, this means that we always have to face the problem of uplifting the effective action from 3 to 4. Now, the general spin 7 case, well, we don't really know how to do it, so we consider this special case on the quotient, and we have seen that an interval is the new ingredient. Then we have this resulting picture of bulk plus boundary, but this means exactly that the local physics in the bulk is just exactly the same as in the Calabi-Yau case. At the boundaries, though, we have some kind of exotic, well, interesting things happening. I have told you about these five planes, the X5, the O5, but we have other examples in which we find three planes, for example. So something that is the analog of this X5 and some kind of fractional O3, so to say. But maybe even other more exotic possibilities are possible. We haven't for sure exhausted the whole list. And there are many things to consider more closely. For example, I didn't really talk about charge matter because from this M2F theory perspective, it's quite elusive. It automatically gets massive when we go to the Coulomb branch. So in M theory, it's always integrated out automatically, and we don't see it in the supergravity effective action. However, we also have a weak coupling picture, so we can consider these seven brains intersecting there. And we have started and performed a preliminary analysis of this, and it looks that once again, once the interval is decompactified, also charge matter comes in supersymmetric multiplets. On a more mathematical perspective, it would be, of course, really good to have explicit examples of this spin 7, especially for all these various things that can happen. And in particular, the problem of the resolution is still open. I mean, we have this hint that, I mean, since we know which kind of objects live there, we could use some kind of known results about O planes. And also, exactly, the Klein-Botter case is for sure something that, okay, maybe it's not really interesting phenomenologically, but very interesting from a conceptual point of view. Okay, phenomenologically speaking, unfortunately, the cases on which we have control of, all the interesting things happens at the boundary of the universe, basically, so it's invisible. But one might hope that engineering things in a different way, some of these effects could survive the decompactification. And this could provide some kind of controlled way to break supersymmetry at high scale. And remember that these X5s come with these non-stable BPS objects. And maybe it's possible to engineer things in such a way that they survive the decompactification. And well, I mean, having something that it's a kind of stable but non-supersymmetric matter could be interesting for cosmological reasons, for example. OK, that's it.
Are there any questions?
Do you have any fibers in your model?
No, we haven't considered putting.
So it has no effect in supersymmetry restoration.
No. It seems that, well, basically, supersymmetry and Lorentz symmetry are tightly bound together. So the scale that breaks the one symmetry breaks also the other, and it looks like as long as you use the M2 brains to restore Lorentz symmetry with the KK modes that become light, this will automatically also restore supersymmetry. So somehow the same states are do the job for both at the same time. And I guess this can be seen from the fact that somehow, I mean, since this is a string compactification, it wants to be supersymmetric, roughly speaking. So, yeah, exactly. As soon as Lorentz symmetry in 4D is restored, supersymmetry comes about.
I guess in the long term, you probably have some M5 brains in mind to wrap vertical divisors in manifold to stabilize body line and such, right? You just haven't looked into them yet?
No, we haven't considered this more complicated setup.
Can you
go to
the last slide for a second?
This one?
Yeah, so I'm trying to understand your first arrow point there. And I know from your guys' story that if you had fluxes, you could access some of the data of the matter in the form of the Church-Simons.
No, yeah, that's true.
What do you mean by the bullet one here?
I mean that you won't see them as fields in the Lagrangian, so to say.
Oh, definitely. Good. But they,
No, no, you're right. I mean,
is there any remnant of the matter once you integrate the things out?
But I think you, if you want matter, you have to have a flux, right?
Well, chiral matter, you have to have flux, but you don't need for matter, you don't need flux.
Ah, I see. Yeah, that's true. Good point. I'm not sure. Because these Chern-Simons terms are usually sensitive only to differences between, like anomalies, roughly speaking.
I guess that was the only way that I saw some aspect of the matter being encoded in the supergravity is by the Chern-Simons. But if you don't have that flux, it seems like there's just nothing left.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, or in any case, it's quite an indirect way to see it in this framework.
All right, so we are going to go to dinner tonight. I think downtown, maybe leaving from here around 6. So if anyone is interested, please shoot me a message. We can push it a little later if later is necessary, perhaps. And let's thank Federico one more time.